aside, and this is the last mention of choreography.
So I have to admit here that for my talk, actually, this is going to be my last mention of cosmology. So in my title, I actually called this cosmological gravity. So it's a theory which has a cosmological constant, but actually the cosmological constant is negative. It's the wrong sign for cosmology. So let me go back to the more modern name, which is topologically massive gravity. Nonetheless, I think there are some connections with what people have been discussing here in cosmology. One in particular is understanding better higher derivative theories of gravity. And for those of you who are not working, this is working mostly in the string theory community. I'm going to give you a few slides at the beginning, sort of giving you an overview of what people are doing and why they're interested in this before I go into details. So what's the framework? So what I'm going to be discussing is three-dimensional gravity theories. So this has traditionally been an area that we use to investigate quantum gravity, quantization of gravity. Einstein gravity on its own in three dimensions has no propagating degrees of freedom, and you can say that this is not a very good model for higher dimensional gravitational theories, although this hasn't stopped people exploring it. Now you can take three-dimensional gravity and you can add higher derivative excitations, but as we've heard many times in this conference, of course there are generically problems with doing this because we get typically ghost-like excitations. So what I'm going to do here is to discuss a particular theory, which is called the topologically massive or cosmological gravity theory, which has been conjectured to be free of such problems for a particular value of one of its parameters. I'm going to revisit this theory using ADS-CFT methods. So the theory I'm thinking about is Einstein gravity with a negative cosmological constant coupled to a gravitational Chan-Simons term. So this is a higher derivative term because we're going to have, in the equations of motion, which I'll give later, we have a term which is the derivative of the Ricci tensor. So this theory, admits ADS-3 as a solution, and in general it also admits asymptotically ADS-3 solutions, such as the famous BTZ black hole. And if we expand about the ADS background, we find perturbative massive modes. But there's a parameter in this theory mu, and when this value is not 1, the massive modes have negative energy, the theory is unstable. Okay, so in the theory community, in the string theory community, there's been a lot of focus recently on a specific value of this parameter, mu equals 1. Because then the negative energy modes seem to disappear, the left-moving gravitational modes, so we have, say, three space-time coordinates, a radial time x-coordinate. We think of left-moving modes, they become pure gauge, and the theory seems to have only a right-moving sector. So this led Strominger and his collaborators to postulate that the theory is actually stable at this value of mu. Space is three-dimensional. So, okay, so space-time is three-dimensional. Okay, so you should understand in the next line. So we have an ADS-3 background. We're saying that, we're postulating a duality with a two-dimensional conformal field theory. So the claim is that that conformal field theory is chiral. So now you have two space dimensions. So we're saying that the left-moving sector is trivial, and it only has a right-moving sector. So this was the claim of Andy Strominger last year. So as many of you know, this claim created an awful lot of controversy. There was a flood of papers because other people, claimed that there were actually non-chiral modes and there are instabilities at this chiral point. So there's a large list of authors, Carlip, Boomil, and Johansson, and others. So at the heart of the question is the question of what are the correct fall-off conditions? What boundary conditions should we allow at infinity? You see, the point is that the unstable modes have fall-off conditions which are different from what you usually allow in three-dimensional gravity. So the three-dimensional Einstein gravity boundary conditions are the famous Brown-Hamel boundary conditions that those of us who work in ADS-CFT have heard much discussed. And the question what one is led to ask is, are the modified fall-off conditions of the unstable modes actually allowed? So that was what the discussion was. So the traditional point of view on this matter is the following. We select physically reasonable fall-off conditions such that things like black holes, relevant solutions satisfy them, and then we check conserved charges are actually finite once we've made that choice. And then you can consider different fall-off or boundary conditions as defining different theories. So this is a viewpoint that goes back to Reggie Teitelbaum, really 35 years ago, 1974. But what I want to argue here, one of the main points of this talk and this work, is that ADS-CFT provides a completely new perspective and leads to a comprehensive answer to these questions. And what I'm going to do is explain the new insights and methodology which originate from ADS-CFT, how this applies to this theory, and how this settles this question once and for all. So, you know, why were we doing this? So, you know, why were the string community thinking about these theories? So for those of you who weren't following this, basically it came from Witten's paper in 2007. So Witten proposed that if we took pure Einstein gravity in three dimensions with a cosmological constant, negative cosmological constant, that this should be holographically dual to a specific kind of two-dimensional conformal field theory, a so-called extremal conformal field theory. Now, the property of this in particular is that there's a large gap in the spectrum. I think this proposal is now basically settled to be incorrect. It's a problem to the purpose of my talk, but basically people think that the extremal CFTs don't exist, and even if they did exist, they would contain things which are not there in gravity. But this was, in a sense, the framework whereby people started looking back at three-dimensional gravity theories and trying to have a correspondence between the pure gravity theories and conformal field theories. So the punchline in this talk is that we're going to find that this theory at the mu equals 1 point, the higher derivative theory at the chiral point, is actually due to a logarithmic conformal field theory. I'm going to give you an operational definition of logarithmic conformal field theories later, but roughly speaking, you can think of them as conformal field theories where in the OPE you get logarithmic structure of theory. Logarithmic CFTs arise a lot in condensed matter, so this correspondence, you know, immediately invites actually applying it in condensed matter theory. So the talk is based on a paper written with Costas and with Baldwin Reyes from Montague. Okay, so let me start with sort of, you know, the framework of ADS-CFT, and you're going to see how we're going to use this to analyze the topologically massive theory. Okay, so suppose I write P plus one dimensional ADS metric. You can think of this as being ADS-3 in Poincaré coordinates. So we have the radial coordinate, and then we have, say, the two space coordinates, space-time coordinates. So the point is that there's a conformal boundary as we take r goes to 0 in this metric. And because there's a conformal boundary, we need to give boundary conditions for all bulk fields at conformal infinity. So even before ADS-CFT, there was a long history about discussing boundary conditions and so on. But now, in the ADS-CFT correspondence, you know, there's a definite defining principle for what these boundary conditions mean. So let's consider a set of fields in the bulk. You can think of this as being scalar fields, symmetric, and so on. We give the boundary conditions at conformal infinity. Now, the statement of ADS-CFT is that these boundary conditions are identified with sources that couple to operators O in the dual conformal field theory. They have a definite physical interpretation. And then the defining dictionary of ADS-CFT, the defining dictionary which relates the bulk theory to the boundary conformal field theory, is that we take the on-shell gravitational action with these boundary conditions, and it acts as a generating functional of CFT correlation functions. So we get one-point functions by differentiating with respect to the source once, you know, higher-point functions by differentiating again. So clearly, this point of view implies immediately a new intuition about what the boundary condition means and what you should allow. When we do quantum field theory, we know that, you know, we have to allow the generating functional to be a function of an arbitrary source. If the sources coupling to the operators have to be unconstrained, because you're going to functionally differentiate with respect to them to get correlation functions. So in particular, we expect that we should be able to specify arbitrary functions or tensors as the boundary conditions for bulk fields. This is the first, you know, conceptual implication of the ADS-CFT dictionary. So let me make this precise in the case of the metric. So let's consider the case where the bulk field is a metric. The corresponding operator in the conformal field theory is a stress-energy tensor. So as I previously mentioned, in the physics literature, there was a long literature prior to the ADS CFP correspondence that talked about asymptotically ADS spacetimes. So particularly well-known works are those of Ashtar and collaborators, Ashtar and Magnon, for example, and you know the Hanoi Teitelbaum and Brown Hanoi works. So in all of these works, what people defined as asymptotically ADS was cases where the metric approaches that of ADS, the metric that I already gave you, as conformal infinity is approached. But this is a problem, because this only allows you to fix a specific boundary metric. If we want to do ADS CFT, we need more general boundary conditions. We have to parameterize the boundary conditions by an unconstrained metric, because the metric is going to act as a source for a CFT operator, the energy momentum constant. So fortunately, this setup was something which was developed, you know, in parallel in the mathematics literature. So this is down to, in particular, Pfeffer and Graham, mathematicians, 1985. So what one can call the corresponding spacetimes is things which are only asymptotically locally ADS. In other words, we allow a general boundary metric, but we insist on the existence of a conformal boundary. So in particular, an asymptotically locally ADS spacetime, it fits, you know, if we think about the behavior of the metric as we go towards the boundary, the conformal boundary of the spacetime, then the metric behaves in this way. Now remember, ADS itself was this with just G being the flat metric. What we require here is simply that this metric here has a limit as we go to the conformal boundary of an arbitrary non-degenerate metric. So we have recovered what we want to be an arbitrary source for the stress energy tensor in the conformal field theory. And I want to emphasize again that the only requirement that we put on this a priori is that it has a non-degenerate metric as R goes to zero. We will determine the precise form of the expansion, so there will be an expansion of this metric here as a function of both these coordinates and the radial coordinates around the R equals zero point. Next.
I appreciate how this works, but there are also lots of other spacetimes with kind of interesting asymptotics at spatial infinity where you expect constraints on that metric. Do you think that that necessarily gets in the way of having a holographic description?
So, I mean, this is outside the framework of what I'm discussing here. I mean, this is.
Sure, I'm just curious because this
so is. I would say, you know, cases where this is constrained, I mean, is not sufficiently understood. I mean, if we did this for asymptotically flat space times where it's definitely constrained, I don't think holography would work.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not attempting to do this.
No, I know. I'm just curious.
Okay, so I want to emphasize this has a non-degenerate limit, and we get the form of the expansion by solving the bulk field equations as a product in the boundary. And in reference to the comment here, in this case, this reduces the solving algebraic equations. The most general asymptotic solution can be easily found any given bulk theory that admits this kind of solutions. This is unlike asymptotic.
Right.
So let me give you an example. Suppose we took Einstein gravity with negative cosmological constant in V plus 1 dimensions. So we solve the bulk equations, and we get the leading term, which I emphasize is unconstrained, and then we get an expansion just by solving the equations of gravity. So the coefficients I've highlighted in blue are locally determined in terms of the source, G0. But the red coefficient, Gd, is only partially determined by the asymptotics. And the physical interpretation of the CFT is that this is related to the one-point function of the stress-energy tensor and thus the bulk conserved charges. You know, you don't expect the one-point function of the stress-energy tensor to be constrained, you know, to be fixed in terms of the source. And it's not. It's true. So this is actually fixed in a given solution, the bulk solution, by regularity conditions. Now, let me notice immediately, so one of the disputes in the power of gravity has been, you know, when we take expansions in the boundary, should we allow logarithmic terms? So let me notice immediately that even in pure Einstein gravity in V plus 1 dimensions, we have such logarithmic terms. So in particular, the coefficient Hd is non-zero in even dimensions, so that's even boundary field theory dimension, odd bulk field theory dimension, and it has a very beautiful interpretation that goes back to the paper of Henningsen's Canderas, 1998, it's related to the one anomaly, the conformal anomaly of the boundary theory. So in particular, HD is the metric variation of the conformal anomaly. So I've come to the case of a V equals 2 in a moment, but for those of you who are not familiar with this expansion, let me tell you what it does. So I give you this data. I give you the data for the boundary source, the source for the operator. I give you the data for what is a one-way function of the source. And this reconstructs for you as a perturbative expansion of the bulk metric. So if I think about this in terms of a space-time diagram, we have an asymptotically ADS space, and what this expansion does is it reconstructs for you the bulk metric in a finite neighborhood of the conformal boundary. So this is the shaded region. One of the big open questions in this subject is to go beyond this perturbative expansion, which breaks down in specific galactic radius, and really get global features of the space-time, including the horizons. This is not playing a role in this talk, but it's a key open question.
So, and just a related question. So, can you expect to reconstruct the bulk up to the horizon or go beyond?
No, generically, this series will actually, unfortunately, it breaks down before you reach the horizon. It's really an important question to understand how that series encapsulates the presence of horizons or not. Or, in other words, if I give you given boundary data of G naught from the stress energy tensor one point function, will the bulk space time have a horizon or not? From that information, it's not going to come out. So, that's not a mathematical. Physical problem. So let me say again that we said that there was a logarithmic term when we had when we're in even dimensions, and it's related to metric variation of conformal anomaly. Now let's go to pure gravity, Einstein gravity in two dimensions. So this is ADS, asymptotically local ADS 3 space. So in that case, the expansion is of this form. We get G2, which remember was locally determined in terms of which was partially determined. But in fact, it happens by accident that H2 vanishes. Now, why does it vanish? It vanishes because in this case, the conformal anomaly is topological. A metric of variation of something that is topological is zero. So in fact, it happens that the pure Einstein gravity in three dimensions, we don't have a logarithmic term. Now, the Brown-Penrose boundary conditions that people put that they put on ADS3 would actually restrict this source to just be the flat metric. They now switch to Euclidean signature. So it's just a flat two-dimensional metric. But let me emphasize that this precise form of the expansion was very specific to pure Einstein gravity. So in particular, even if you couple to matter, you change the coefficients and you can induce logarithmic terms. So just coupling it to a free massless scalar indeed induces a logarithmic term for the expansion. H2 is non-zero in this theory. Already in the cases of ADS-CFT that we know and understand very well. Now, another important thing about, so I'm sort of talking about how ADS-CFT gives you a new way of understanding boundary conditions. So another immediate implication is a new approach to conserve charges. So in quantum field theory, we compute energy from taking the energy momentum tensor of the field theory and integrating in this way to get the energy integrating over space. And generically, of course, we know that when we actually do this in quantum field theory, this is very subtle, we have UV infinities and we're in a line. So in the ADS-CFT correspondence, remember that the stress energy tensor comes from the metric variation of conventional action. Now this expression is also infinite. But this is now due to the infinite volume in space-time. UV infinities in field theory can match the infrared divergences in space-time. It's due to the infinite volume of ADS spaces, and this also means renormalization. So there's a whole procedure of this called holographic renormalization, which renormalizes the bulk gravitational theory essentially by adding boundary covariant counterterms. So this was initiated in a paper 11 years ago by Henderson Stenders, and is a very highly thought tool. So when you add boundary counterterms in this way, you obtain a finite one-point function for the stress energy tensor, and schematically you can think of it as this way. So as I mentioned before, it's proportional to the coefficient in the expansion, which was undetermined,
And then there's a known functional of the metric G0, which also is needed in here to satisfy appropriate ward identities and so on. One can prove rigorously from first principle that the holographic charges obtained from this are the correct gravitational conserved charges. They're equivalent to all other gravitational conserved charges. Now let me tell you about, talk about how this all applies to the topological massive theory. So let me go back to this theory, which was written down first by Deza, Jacquive, and Pendleton. So it's Einstein gravity, and we have a Chern-Simons term added to it. And if we write down the equations of motion and process them, we get the usual vacuum Einstein equations, and then we get a higher derivative term as well. So it's the covariant derivative of the Ricci tensor, it's a higher derivative term. Now you can see immediately that ADS is the solution of these equations, because of course the Ricci tensor of ADS is covariantly constant. So these equations of motion admit an ADS solution. They admit asymptotically ADS solutions, such as the famous BTZ black hole. And as well, if you perturb about ADS, you get perturbative massive modes. But these massive modes, at least when mu equals 1, people have known for a long time, the massive modes have negative energy, the theory is considered to be unstable. So now let's go back to this debate about what happens at this special point where this coupling, the mu, is 1. So as I said, motivated by various considerations of Witten's holography conjecture, Strominger and his collaborators started re-exploring this theory. And they made various claims. In particular, they claimed that if we go to the special point mu equals 1, that the dual conformal field theory for the ADS is actually chiral at this point. So there are no left-moving modes. So in the bulk, this means that we can find no left-moving modes satisfying ordinary boundary conditions. And they also noticed that in the conformal field theory, the left-moving central charge, CL, goes to 0 at this chiral point. And they claimed that the theory is stable at mu equals 1. So in particular, there are no negative energy states. So they then make the proposal that if you took the topologically massive theory at this specific value of mu, there would be a correspondence between a theory and a chiral conformal field theory, and then they then try to push on and do an analog of what we had proposed. But these claims were immediately hit by controversy, because people took, say, the ADS background, solved the fluctuation equations, and they found a non-chiral mode of the theory. So this was found in particular first by Blumiller and Johansson last year. So their non-chiral mode of the theory, the fluctuation, had this asymptotic form, putting in the same way I wrote it before. In other words, it has a logarithmic, a certain G2 and H2. In other words, it has a logarithmic term in it. So Strominger and others claim that because it has a logarithmic term in the expansion, this is something which is not allowed by Brown-Hanoff boundary conditions, and one shouldn't allow this mode of the theory. There was a long debate with papers going back and forth between different people of whether you can allow these boundary conditions, whether they're consistent. But at the beginning of this year, I think it was proven to most people's satisfaction by Hanoff, Martinez, and Troncoso that the conserved charges are perfectly finite with such boundary conditions, so this mode should be allowed. Now we want to sort of, settle this argument once and for all, using the holographic intuitions. So let me say several things about this. The first thing is the fact that we find a log, I've already tried to convince you, is not at all surprising, because the sub-leading coefficient routinely changes when the bulk action is modified from pure Einstein gravity. So in particular, routinely in ADS-CFP, we've seen sub-leading logs, we understand what's going on, we understand the connection with conformal anomalies, there's no problem in this. Secondly, and very importantly, the form of the asymptotic expansion should not be fixed by hand. It should be derived by solving the bulk equations asymptotically with given boundary conditions. I'm going to return to the most general solution in a moment. So the new holographic methodology we propose is to derive the most general solution of the bulk equations with general boundary conditions for all fields. There are general results, which I've referenced, which guarantee that conserved charges will be well defined and that they can be obtained from the holographic one-point functions. And in our framework, it's actually very easy to go further and compute two-point functions, higher-point functions, and conformal field theory. So now let me move on to actually,
This holographic methodology, there could be a, so there's always a question of whether then there's global existence of solutions given certain kinds of boundary data. And I was wondering if in three dimensions we've got these two potential classes of boundary conditions, whether it's any easier to make statements about global existence of solutions for given boundary data.
Well, I think first of all, the two things are completely disconnected. I mean, first of all, we do the asymptotic analysis and we decide, you know, what can occur. And then we later ask what pairs of data give rise to regular solutions. So, and you're right that actually in three dimensions, this problem is more practical. Plus, for pure Einstein gravity, this was, you know, discussed years ago by Sir Euclid and Hipposthus. In this framework, I mean, we haven't gone forward to do this, but one would indeed expect that actually, you know, there would be a nice mathematical understanding about what pairs of boundary data are consistent with regular solutions. And that's an interesting question. Okay, so let me now tell you about holography for this case. So there are two, in a sense, technical and important subtleties relative to earlier works on holography, which is perhaps why people didn't immediately do this. So let's focus first on what people have called the power of the point theory from one. So the first new ingredient compared to previous holographic discussions is that we're really analyzing field equations which are higher derivative. So field equations included a term which had covariant derivative of a Ricci tensor, the third order in derivatives. And this means, in particular, that we have two independent pieces of boundary data. So we have a metric, which we would usually have, but we also have an extrinsic curvature. There's an immediate interpretation for this. The metric G naught is a source of the energy in the Lenski tensor, but a new piece of data, which is the extrinsic curvature, which I'll call a boundary field B, is going to be a source for a distinct operator. So the fact that we have higher order equations corresponds to having extra boundary conditions and more sources for new operators. This is something which I think was not appreciated before.
There's another sort of technical point which we have to worry about, which is that this new operator T is actually obtained from a limit of an irrelevant operator as we take this limit v goes to 1. So again, returning to quantum field theory intuition, you know that if you're in a conformal field theory and you start coupling irrelevant operators, this generates severe UV divergences and the theory is no longer conformal in UV. The exact holographic analog of the statement is in gravity, if you start introducing sources, finite sources for irrelevant operators, you get severe IR divergences, you change the asymptotics of the space-times. But the way to bypass the problem is the same in both cases. You just treat the source perturbatively. So what we're going to do is it's just work the first order in B naught, which is this irrelevant operator, and that suffices for what we need to do here, which is compute confined functions. Okay, so now I said what was the logic. The logic is to obtain the most general solution of the equations of motion asymptotically, and understand the relationship between the holographic correlation functions and the terms which appear in the asymptotic expansion. So when we take the most general asymptotic solution, we get the terms that we would have in Einstein gravity, but we also get a leading log term, B naught, which was related to the source for a new operator. And we get a sub-leading log term, which is only partially constrained by the asymptotic analysis. So in a sense, it's exactly analogous to what we had for pure Einstein gravity. There we had the source, which was for the stress energy tensor, and the G2 talked about its one-point function. Here we have a source for a new operator occurring here logarithmically, and this is going to be related to its one-point function. So again, these unconstrained terms relate to the boundary values of the metric and extrinsic curvature. They're sources for boundary operators, the stress energy tensor, and a new operator. And the fact that G2 and B2 are constrained partially by the asymptotic analysis is something which we expect from operator ward identities. So then we go through Stoner manipulations, and we get a map between the holographic one-point functions, so one-point functions in the conformal field theory, and the boundary data. So this is, you know, matching the one-point function in terms of terms in the asymptotic expansion. The new operator, indeed, is also expressed in terms of coefficient for the asymptotic expansions. So we've got the renormalized one-point function for the stress energy tensor. We can use this to obtain conserved charges. So for example, we know that there's a black hole solution, the BTZ black hole solution of this theory. So if we look at the stress energy tensor for the BTZ black hole, we see that it becomes chiral as u equals 1. So in particular, if we just substitute the black hole solution, it's characterized by the locations of its inner and outer horizons, r plus r minus, then the left moving component of the stress energy tensor is 0, the right moving component is non-zero. And we get certain conserved charges, the mass and the angular momentum, in terms of components of the stress energy tensor. So as I said, the TIJ satisfies expected anomalous Ward identities. There's a trace anomaly, there's a diffeomorphism anomaly, and then there's a certain non-covariant functional of the metric and connection which occurs here. And so maybe in view of time, I'll actually skip this. I mean, there's a nice interpretation about why this occurs. Okay. So there's a nice interpretation about, you know, why there's a non-covariant functional of the metric and connection. So if we think about anomalies in quantum field theory, and we go back to, you know, the defining papers by people like West and Cimino, we see that, you know, that if Tij follows from the variation of effective action, then the anomaly under a diffeomorphism zeta, which we call H of zeta, has to satisfy certain consistency conditions. So if we act with another diffeomorphism, the anticommutation has to give H with the anticommutator of the generators of the diffeomorphisms. So this is consistency conditions for quantum field theory anomalies. But there's a beautiful discussion about how the consistent anomaly is not always covariant. So you can find an improvement term Yij such that the improved stress energy tensor transforms as a tensor, but then T hat is not the variation in effective action. So this is all standard quantum field theory, which we reproduce holographically. Remember, we did a bulk computation, and we've reproduced the same properties. Okay, so let's go on to the interesting thing. So I've given you a sort of, you know, very precise map between, you know, the bulk theory and the quantum field theory information. But what we really want to do to identify this as being a logarithmic conformal field theory is to compute two-point functions. So how do we do this? As already referenced by Rob, what we do is we have to compute, we have to look for regular solutions of the linearized field equations in the ADS background. This gives us a non-local relationship between the VEV mode and the source mode of the asymptotic expansion. We can functionally differentiate the one-point function and get the two-point function. I mean, it's a standard procedure. And when we do this, from the general solution, what we extract is the following two-point functions for our theory. So just look for a moment at the bottom of these two-point functions. So this is the right-moving stress-energy tensor, and it has this form of two-point function. So you should recognize this from, you know, your favorite string theory course or conformal field theory course. This is the two-point function expected for the stress-energy tensor, and this will be related to the right-moving central charge. But in the left-moving sector, we have two operators, the new operator, little t, and the left-moving stress-energy tensor. And notice in particular that in these two-point functions, first of all, tt is 0, which implies a vanishing central charge. But we also have logarithmic terms arising, and this is non-diagonalizable. You see there's an off-diagonal term here. So in a sense, you could think of these relations as the defining features of a logarithmic conformal field theory. So these, what we got, is precisely the non-zero two-point functions of a logarithmic conformal field theory. So again, if I take the very familiar part, which is the right-moving sector, this is identified in my normalizations with a right-moving central charge. So the central charge on the right is 3 over the Newton constant. And because the TT correlated with 0, the left-moving central charge is 0. But in the left moving sectors, the operators little t and big t form a logarithmic pair. The two-point functions were non-diagonalizable. And when this happens, people characterize this structure, this logarithmic structure, essentially by this coefficient here, which is sometimes called the new anomaly parameter, little b, and it takes this value in this case. So the point is, you see, suppose we have a logarithmic conformal field theory with zero central charges. We want to characterize, use central charges to characterize the number of degrees of freedom of conformal field theory. If the central charge is zero, you've lost that measure of characterizing the difference between different conformal field theories. People use this coefficient, little b, coming from this two-point function as a new anomaly parameter to characterize, you know, different logarithmic conformal field theories. So in the same way that we think of central charges as characterizing two-dimensional conformal field theories, we should think of this parameter b as characterizing a logarithmic conformal field theory. Mm-hmm. That's in the box. So we solve the linearized field equations in bulk. We ask for a regular solution. We plug it into our holographic one-point functions, and we have a relationship between the source and the one-point function.
What's the topology of the bulk?
So in this case, I'm just an ABS3, pure ABS3, and I'm just solving for regular linearized fluctuations of our function. This is the standard ADS dictionary of how one could explain motion functions. And as I said here, you know, if you wanted to go further, it's the complete conception is straightforward. You just have to go to higher order and go to the functions. So this should convince you that mu equals one. We have a logarithmic conformal field theory. It's with these specific parameters, the central charges in the normal. Well, it's actually very interesting here. So when we talk about things which have zero central charge, people in trying to construct logarithmic conformal field theories try to do so by taking ordinary conformal field theories and then taking C goes to zero limit. So it's actually very interesting here to ask, you know, what about the behavior slightly away from mu equals one? So we also analyze the theory in the neighborhood around mu equals one. So characterizing this by a parameter lambda, analyzing the lambda, we get the same kind of behavior as before. So we solve the linearized equations of motion near the boundary, and instead of getting logarithmic terms, we get terms like this. So we get the usual source for the stress energy tensor, and we get another source for a new operator. Now you can see that as lambda goes to zero, this indeed exactly goes back to, you know, you write this as e to the minus lambda log rho, it exactly, you know, approaches a logarithmic term. So we have, again, two sources, one for a stress energy tensor and one for a new operator, which I will call x. We can go through the same procedure to get the one-point functions of these operators in terms of the asymptotic data, and we can get the two-point functions in this case, too. So this is a set of two-point functions. So we have the two-point functions for the stress energy tensor, the two-point functions for x. You can read off immediately from these expressions the left and the right moving central charges, and clearly the left moving central charge is indeed going to zero as mu goes to one. And the operator x has certain conformal weights, which can be read off from here. So it has weights 2 plus lambda and lambda. So as lambda goes to zero or mu goes to one, the central charge, the C left, goes to zero, and the weight of x goes to 2, 0. So in particular, we can take these correlation functions, and we can take a very smooth limit to what we had before at mu equals 1. So the operator T that we had, which was a logarithmic pair of the stress energy tensor, is given by this particular combination of the operators x and t, and we recover the value of the B anomaly that we had previously. So in fact, this discussion exactly mirrors the degeneration of conformal field theory to a logarithmic conformal field theory. So as I mentioned before, there's lots of discussion in the literature of avoiding the C goes to zero catastrophe. So the point is that if you take a conformal field theory and you try and take C goes to zero limit, you want to ask that your operator product expansion, correlation functions, behave sensibly. And one way of doing this is precisely to start from this structure and take the limit lambda goes to zero. And this was done in particular by Kogan and Nichols a few years ago. you know, exactly as here, the logarithmic partner of their stress energy tensor at the, you know, at the logarithmic point originated from taking another primary whose dimension also collapsed the dimension Q0 in the C goes to zero limit. So why this is interesting is because there's been lots of discussion in the literature about the right way of taking the C goes to zero limit, avoiding a catastrophe. But it's in fact their approach which we see realized holographically in our strongly interacting system. Now, another thing you can immediately say is, I didn't highlight this, but there's a minus sign here, which should get you nervous and not worrying about unitarity or stability. From the form of the two-point functions, we see that the CFT contains a state of negative norm, and we can also show that the energy is negative in that state. So I mentioned before that it was already known or believed that the theory away from U equals 1 was going to be unstable. So indeed, this is a counterpart of what people discussed before, the bulk instability due to negative energy. So let me summarize this, and before telling you a little bit more what I think it means. So the summary is that topologically massive gravity at what was called the chiral point is due to a logarithmic CFT. Logarithmic CFTs are not unitary. This is not unitary. I think I would advocate that a more appropriate name for the new equals one theory is not chiral point, but perhaps a logarithmic point. The expressions we have for two-point functions indicate, you know, kind of expected problems with unitarity, positivity. Then when zero norm states at new equals one, that's a, you know, it's not unitary, logarithmic CFT. Away from new equals one, we have negative norm states, we have negative conformal weights. So this is not a theory to be taken seriously as a fundamental theory of gravity. Now, this is, you know, one can still try and do what Strominger and the others have proposed, which is to try and restrict to the right-moving sector of the theory, the chiral sector. Potentially, you could get a consistent chiral theory. What we've done does not disprove this. Now, in particular, if you're going to do this, if you're going to try and restrict to some subset of the operators, you better make sure that, you know, the other operators don't get generated in the OPE. So, you know, in particular, a necessary, although insufficient condition would be that, you know, the three-point functions between the right-moving components of the stress-energy tensor and the left-moving, or, you know, the T's and the capital T's, are zero. This is not something we check. But it's actually interesting to note that in the Kogan and Nichols paper, remember, they were taking the same degeneration as C goes to zero as we were. This was actually a condition which held. And it would be interesting to compute that three-point function holographically, which is straightforward. You just need to, you know, analyze the equations to one more order. I should say, though, that there's actually no known example of a logarithmic CFT, which does admit a truncation for this chiral sector. So, you know, it's not obvious that this is going to work. Now, you can say, well, why, you know, what's the you know, the use of this analysis? So it seems problematic to take this theory seriously as a fundamental theory, which is basically what was being advocated in the string theory community. But at the same time, it's actually very interesting, the fact that we have a correspondence between bulk gravity and a logarithmic conformal field theory. It could have very interesting applications to condensed matter systems. So there's a kind of, you know, explosion of interest in the string theory community about using holographic modeling to describe condensed matter systems. Yep.
Negative two CFT?
Yes.
Sort of anti-free scalar,
yes.
CFT. I thought that if you truncated that theory to the sector which is translationally invariant along the fermionic, you know, which is invariant under the shifts of the fermionic scalar, I thought that then that theory is no longer logarithmic.
Yeah, but if they haven't really shown that you can glue it together and make it consistently logarithmic, I remember we can discuss afterwards.
Okay.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm aware of this example, but, you know, okay. Maybe, perhaps the experts in logarithmic CFT, there is a running. Okay, so there's an explosion of interest in using holographic modeling for condensed matter systems. And from this perspective, I don't think that we should be sad that we have a logarithmic conformal field theory. Quite the contrary, because in condensed matter systems,
logarithmic conformal field theories were actually introduced to describe condensed matter systems. So in particular, systems with quench disorder, quantum Hall plateaus, logarithmic CFTs were introduced in order to describe these. And actually, it's been difficult from the CFT perspective to build a consistent logarithmic CFT. So this might provide a lot of interesting examples. So further conclusions, we try to provide evidence that topologically massive gravity is dual to a logarithmic CFT at the chiral point. It would be interesting to kind of do the same kind of analysis with the new massive gravity, which was written down very recently. So this is yet another three-dimensional theory with higher derivative interactions, which seems to be finite. And you know, one would actually suspect that this actually has the specific values of its parameters is related to logarithmic conformal field theories. All of these theories actually admit things with different massive products. So this relates to a question which was given earlier. They're actually warped ADS solutions. It's qualitatively different asymptotics, different UV behavior in field theory. It would be interesting to go beyond and actually extend the holographic set up to this class of solutions too. But I mean, more generally, and to people who work in different things, you know, the main motivation for this is to increase the number of quantum field theories that can be realized very precisely holographically. So we now see that we can realize logarithmic conformal field theories holographically. And you know, the set of quantum field theories with different universality classes that can be modeled is increasing. That's important for two reasons. You know, one is, of course, the question about whether gravity is holographic. In the context of this conference, it's whether we can use holography as a useful tool for cosmology and go from negative cosmological constant to positive. But also, you know, as many of you know, there's an explosion of interest in using holographic models to apply to condensed matter physics, the phenomenology, and elsewhere, and extending the class of quantum field theories that you can model clearly provides, you know, increasing models that you can use. Let me stop there.
If you like this action in the first order formalism, then the point we use one especially in that it becomes a single SF2R and some theory. Does that play no role in this analysis? It seems funny it doesn't pop up.
Generically, I mean, even if you go back to pure Einstein gravity, writing things in the first order formalism makes boundary conditions that reach their boundary conditions very well manifest. And I would have said that this is responsible for many confusions in the literature. So remember, you want to impose it that Dirichlet boundary conditions will met.
Yes.
It's very
non-manifest
to do this because
of the performance.
That's
the sense of short answer. I know it's not just a short-term theory of SFR, it's a constraint stuff only, but it seems funny that there's no relation between that kind of...
So I'm saying that the relations are somewhat subtle,
right.
and there has been a lot of confusion and interest in even the pure answer because of this. I mean, from this perspective, I think it's much more natural not to be manifest with the
holographic analysis. I guess maybe a related question: this chiral gravity, the gravitational transcendence term, in this case, right, is written in terms of the Christoffel symbols, and I was at some point also confused whether that's equivalent to writing down the transcendence term in terms of the spin. If you would go to a first order formalism, if you write down the transcendence term in terms of the spin connection.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think
is it clear whether those things are the same or not? They are the same.
But then it depends whether you think of it as a function of the drive line or whether you think of it as an independent variable.
So you don't use it as, let's say, Galatini, where you use them as independent variables.
Yeah, then you could solve it by some constraint. Right?
So then it's different. If you use it as a fundamental variable, it's a metric.
Yeah, but I agree. Mm-hmm.
So then the claim is. Okay. So at least at a formal level, if one would do things at the first quantized theory, this would be the SF2R transcendence theory, the chiral, this conformal point, or the logarithmic point.
But as Marika said, this is about different boundary conditions, right? So if you translate into that, if you do the filter definition, then you will have to impose strange boundary conditions.
I know.
For each time. So if you're willing to do that, it would be the same, just the filter definition.
But I think even at the bulk action level, there's a term multiplying the torsion, which would be like automatic fire. in this formalism that's got nothing to do with the Kleinheim. But for the transcendental formulation, it would be the Kleinheim. And that changes the way you substitute when you replace the equation of the
any other questions? If not, let's think all this more.